Hello, this is Randy Thompson, sitting in for George Douglas. Welcome to the Triangle Radio Reading Services, The Week magazine, which offers the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. For the next hour, I shall be reading articles from several sections of The Week magazine, and it's going to be a little bit different today since George Douglas read from this same issue last week. We'll be covering a number of different sections that he wasn't able to get to because, in fact, The Week magazine was not published this week. They only have 48 issues a year, and this is one of those 2 weeks, right after July 4th, that they don't have an issue. But we'll fill you in on all the latest news that was not covered last week. So we start out today's issue with a section that's entitled, It Wasn't All Bad. Once again, this is from The Week magazine, July 5 through 12, 2013. Those sections that were not covered in last week's reading by George Douglas. Divers off the coast of North Carolina have recovered two cannons used by the infamous pirate Blackbeard on a slave ship he commandeered in the 18th century. The wreck of the Queen Anne's Revenge was first discovered in 1996, but divers are only now removing the largest artifacts from its watery grave. Blackbeard captured the French ship in 1717 and sailed it up and down the eastern seaboard and around the West Indies. He ran it aground the following year after plundering Charleston, South Carolina. Along with the 11-foot cannons, divers also raised a 3,000-pound anchor from the deep. The Smithsonian National Zoo's new red panda staged a daring jailbreak this week, escaping his enclosure in Washington, D.C. for almost 12 hours. Rusty, one of the only 10,000 red pandas left in the world, disappeared from the National Zoo overnight this week, sparking a citywide panda hunt and a social media frenzy. The cat-sized animal was safely recovered the next day after a Twitter user spotted him in her neighborhood and sent an alert to zookeepers. Rusty only arrived at the zoo in early June, and it's hoped he will mate with the zoo's resident red panda, Shama. And that takes us to Only in America. Only in America, a Georgia middle school girl was kicked off her school's football team because her presence might trigger lustful thoughts in her teammates. Maddie Blythe, 12, said she was told she could not return to the Strong Rock Christian School's football team despite her strong play because the Bible discourages such gender mixings. Said Maddie, "It's the taking my dream and throwing it in the trash." A New York City police officer was reprimanded for speaking one sentence of Spanish while on duty. Hesania Guzman said that when another officer said she was going to buy coffee, she responded in Spanish. Hours later, the NYPD reprimanded her. "We should be speaking in one voice, which is English," said a spokeswoman. That takes us to the section of the magazine entitled The World at a Glance. And here we have stories from Calgary, Alberta, Geneva, Lake Nicaragua, Nicaragua, Rio de Janeiro, Moscow, Nanga Parbat, Pakistan, Damascus, Syria, and Canberra, Australia. First, from Calgary, Alberta, washed away. Southern Alberta is underwater after getting more rain in 48 hours last week than it usually does in a month. In Calgary, where two rivers meet, some neighborhoods were under 5 feet of water, submerging cars. About 75,000 residents were evacuated, and the government declared a state of emergency. With the Bow River looking like an ocean and the Elbow River overflowing its dam, Mayor Naheed Nenshi asked residents to check on each other. "There's nothing preventing you from knocking on your neighbor's door," Nenshi said. As the waters receded, officials were worried about contaminated water, damaged infrastructure, and a mosquito infestation. And from Geneva, rampant abuse of women. More than a third of all women around the world are victims of physical or sexual violence by their partners, the World Health Organization said in its first worldwide survey on this topic. "Violence against women is a global health problem of epidemic proportions," said WHO Director General Margaret Chan. The domestic violence rate was highest in Africa, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia, where 37% of women report being abused, and it's lowest in North America with 23%. More than 600 million women live in countries where wife beating is not a crime. The WHO urged that healthcare workers regularly screen for domestic violence. And in Nicaragua, we have this. Take that, Panama. A Chinese businessman has won a 50-year concession to build a canal in Nicaragua to rival the Panama Canal. Wang Jing says his $40 billion project will connect the Caribbean with the Pacific by way of Lake Nicaragua. At 178 miles long, the waterway would be three times longer than the Panama Canal and has drawn opposition from environmentalists who say it would threaten the country's main supply of drinking water as well as crocodile breeding grounds. President Daniel Ortega, who pushed approval of the project through his docile National Assembly, says it will generate tens of thousands of jobs for the impoverished country. China's biggest state-owned construction company is scheduled to start digging next year and to finish the canal by 2020. And from Rio de Janeiro, scrap the systems. In an effort to appease raging anti-government protesters, President Dilma Rousseff has proposed rewriting the Brazilian constitution. More than 1 million people thronged streets in Rio, Sao Paulo, and other cities last week demanding that the government stop spending money on stadiums for the 2014 World Cup and 2016 Olympics and start providing services for the poor. Rousseff called for a national referendum on sweeping reforms, including channeling all oil revenue into schools, investing in public transport, and creating a new constitutional assembly to overhaul the corrupt political system. But such a referendum would have to be approved by the current dysfunctional National Congress, which has refused for years to bring the oil and transport proposals to a vote. And from Moscow we have this. Is Snowden stuck? Fugitive NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden remained holed up in Moscow's airport this week after bolting from Hong Kong. The open government group WikiLeaks said one of its lawyers was with him. The U.S. asked Russia to extradite Snowden, who has been charged with treason for leaking details of a vast U.S. surveillance program. But Russia and the U.S. have no extradition treaty, and President Vladimir Putin said that since Snowden was in the airport's transit lounge rather than on Russian territory proper, he wasn't Russia's concern. "I prefer not to deal with these issues," he said. "It's like shearing a baby pig. There's a lot of squealing, but not a lot of wool." Ecuador, meanwhile, said it had received Snowden's asylum request and would take a few months to consider it. And from Nanga Parbat, Pakistan, the Taliban kills climbers. The Pakistani Taliban has killed 9 foreign climbers, including one American, and a local guide at a Himalayan base camp in Pakistan. Militants stormed into a hotel at the camp, held the staff hostage, and gunned down the entire climbing party as they slept. A Taliban spokesman said the attack was retaliation for a U.S. drone strike last month that killed Walur Rehman, the group's second-in-command. Through this killing, we gave a message to the international community to ask the U.S. to stop drone attacks, the group said. The attack is expected to further hurt Pakistan's already suffering tourism industry. Nanga Parbat is the world's ninth tallest mountain. And from Damascus, Syria, U.S. is already helping. U.S. Special Operation troops and CIA agents have been secretly training Syrian rebels for months, the Los Angeles Times reported. Sources said rebels have been visiting U.S. bases in Jordan and Turkey in small groups since November to get trained in using anti-tank and anti-aircraft weaponry. Those from the CIA, we would sit and talk with them during breaks from training, and afterward they would try to get information on the situation inside Syria, said one rebel commander. The White House refused to confirm the story, but did say the U.S. was providing substantial assistance to the rebels. And finally, in Canberra, Australia, female PM ousted. Kevin Rudd returned as Australian Prime Minister this week, ousting Julia Gillard in a party vote similar to the one in which she toppled him 3 years ago. Reinstating Rudd as Prime Minister is Labour's attempts to woo back voters, as polls suggest the party will lose badly in the September election. Gillard, Australia's first female Prime Minister, faced intense opposition throughout her tenure, but pushed through several social reforms, including greater funding for education and health care for the disabled. But her introduction of a carbon tax hurt her with voters. Gillard said she was quitting politics but was proud of her legacy. It will be easier for the next woman, she said, and the woman after that, and the woman after that. And that takes us to the gossip section in the Week magazine. And we have this. The rivalry between tennis star Serena Williams and Maria Sharapova has spilled off the court into mutual personal attacks. Williams was quoted in a Rolling Stone interview criticizing a top five player for being boring and dating a guy with a black heart. Supposedly a reference to Sharapova and her boyfriend, Grigor Dimitrov, a tennis player to whom Williams had previously been romantically linked. Sharapova fired back at Williams, who is currently dating her coach, in a press conference. If she wants to talk about something personal, maybe she should talk about her relationship, she said. And her boyfriend that was married and is getting a divorce and has little kids. Williams said this week she had apologized to Sharapova for her comments. A source close to Kanye West and Kim Kardashian has told TMZ.com why they named their infant daughter Northwest. The name is more inspirational than directional, according to a friend of the couple. North represents Kim and Kanye's highest point together as a couple, said the source. What's north of north? The couple has supposedly told friends. Nothing. And that takes us to Best Columns International. We start out with this, How They See Us, Protecting Snowden. Jason Bourne, eat your heart out, said Pepe Escobar in the Asia Times, Hong Kong. American whistleblower Edward Snowden has proved a master spy with his meticulously timed operation. First, he revealed to The Guardian the NSA's massive global surveillance program that sweeps up communications from Americans and non-Americans alike. Then he went underground in Hong Kong to prepare his escape. As he knew Washington would come after him with all guns, drones, blazing. Then Snowden unveiled another massive leak to the South China Morning Post, detailing how the U.S. hacks into Chinese computers with abandon. An enraged Washington canceled his passport. By that time, he was on a plane to Moscow and beyond reach. He even tricked the world press into thinking he was on a flight to Ecuador by way of Havana. But when the plane left this week, it was packed with journalists. But Snowden was still at Sheremetyevo Airport in Moscow. A video of his empty plane seat became a YouTube sensation throughout Russia. Hong Kong handled the affair just right, said the South China Morning Post, Hong Kong. Chinese authorities were secretly pleased that the hypocrisy of U.S. claims of Beijing's cyber spying had come home to roost. But to actually give Snowden political asylum would jeopardize diplomatic gains. Fortunately, the Hong Kong administration finessed the situation by requesting more information for the U.S. before it could issue a warrant, a request that brought Snowden more time to hop that flight to Moscow. He left us with plenty to think about, said Ming Jinwei in Xinhua, China. Thanks to him, we now have proof that the U.S., which has long been trying to play innocent as a victim of cyber attacks, has turned out to be the biggest villain in our age. Washington has been trying to paint China as some kind of dastardly cyber fiend, an accusation that figured prominently in the recent summit between President Xi Jinping and Barack Obama. So much for that claim. Now the Americans are scapegoating Russia as well, said Yelena Chinkova in Pravda, Russia. Washington demanded that Russia extradite the fugitive, a request President Vladimir Putin called ravings and rubbish. He coolly pointed out that since Snowden never left the airport, he's simply a passenger in transit. The incident has left U.S. lawmakers sputtering in outrage. Putin always seemed eager to put a finger in the eye of the U.S., said Senator Charles Schumer. Senator Lindsey Graham, for his part, warned that the U.S. would show Russia its actions won't go unpunished. Ecuador isn't afraid of American retaliation, said La Hora, Ecuador, in an editorial. We gave asylum to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and will probably do the same for Snowden. Assange says he helped Snowden arrange passage here. This is a reason for national pride. There are some governments that act more upon their own interest, but we do not, said Foreign Minister Ricardo Patino. We act upon our principles. And from Canada, we have this, tolerating savagery on the ice. This is an editorial written by The Globe and Mail. When a violent assault is not a crime? When it happens on the ice, said Toronto Globe and Mail. Canada has a quote-unquote cultural tolerance for brutal behavior during hockey games, even at the junior varsity level, and kids are getting badly hurt. At a game in Woodstock, Ontario, a few months ago, a 16-year-old was punched viciously in the head 9 or 10 times while down on the ice by an opposing player standing over him. This wasn't some kind of rough check, but a flat-out beating. Vengeance exacted for the sin of spraying the goalie with ice while breaking. The victim's parents videotaped the attack and gave it to police, but authorities are still trying to decide whether to bring charges against the perpetrator. The police chief said the act falls into a gray area because, in his words, quote-unquote, society condones a certain level of violence in hockey. Such a mealy-mouthed appeal to cultural norms would be rightly scoffed at if an immigrant group used it to justify violence against its own members. The stoning of women for adultery, for example, may be culturally acceptable to some groups, but it is illegal here in Canada. And so is beating up a kid who's lying on the ice. An attempt to annihilate another person's consciousness is not part of Hockey. And that takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Health and Science. And we have these articles: Health Scare of the Week, Infections and Mental Health, Did Men Cause Menopause, Pollution's Links to Autism, and The Life-Saving Effect of HPV Vaccines. But first, Health Scare of the Week, Infections and Mental Health. Infections may make us more vulnerable to depression. Researchers at the University of Copenhagen tracked the health status of more than 3.5 million Danes for 33 years to see how many times they were hospitalized for any type of infection and whether or not they were diagnosed with depression or another mood disorder. They found that a single hospitalization increased the risk of later developing a mood disorder by 62%. And the more infections a patient developed, the more the risk increased, LiveScience.com reports. People who had an autoimmune disorder in which the immune system attacks healthy cells and tissues were also 45% more likely to develop a mood disorder, a risk that increased exponentially if they contracted an infection. Like autoimmune diseases, infections can damage brain cells and nerve cells, causing inflammation that may interfere with how those cells communicate and potentially reduce our ability to regulate our emotions. Experts say a healthy diet and regular exercise are the best ways to defend against both infection and depression. Now, did men cause menopause? Now there's one more thing for women to blame on men: menopause. It's long been assumed that men prefer younger women because older ones can't bear children and pass on their genes. A provocative new study suggests it happened the other way around, namely that women develop menopause because men's lust for younger women made it pointless for them to remain fertile into old age. Using a computer model to track the evolutionary consequences of mating preferences, researchers at McMaster University in Canada found that if it were not for men's age bias in selecting a mate, women would be reproducing like men are for their whole lives. Computational biologist Rama Singh tells CBSNews.com, "That, after all, is the norm in the animal kingdom, where menopause is rare. Male chimpanzees, our closest relatives, actually prefer to mate with older females. The study suggests that men's preferences for younger mates allowed certain genetic mutations to flourish that over time undermine the fertility of older women. If true, that would mean that in evolutionary terms, menopause is reversible. Indeed, if women were to refuse to have sex with men of a certain age, study co-author Jonathan Stone says, male menopause will be the eventual evolutionary outcome." And then we have this: pollution's links to autism. A new study has found the strongest link yet between air pollution and autism, which experts now say affects 1 in 50 U.S. school children. Pregnant women who lived in areas with high levels of diesel exhaust and airborne mercury were found to be twice as likely to have a child with autism as those living in places with the lowest pollution levels. The presence of other pollutants such as lead, magnesium, methylene chloride increased the odds of having a child with autism by 50%. The study, conducted by the Harvard University School of Public Health, analyzed data from a long-term nationwide study of 116,430 nurses, 325 of whom had children with autism. "Our findings raise concerns," said the author Andrea Roberts, tells NYDailyNews.com, "since depending on the pollutant, 20 to 60% of the women in our study lived in areas where risks of autism was elevated." And finally, this Health and Science article, the life-saving effect of HPV vaccines. Vaccinations against the human papillomavirus may be controversial, but a new study has shown it to be stunningly effective. The rate of infection with the cancer-causing strain of HPV has been cut in half among American teenage girls since 2006, when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention First recommended that 11- and 12-year-old girls be vaccinated against the sexually transmitted virus. That success comes even though only about a third of girls that age have received the full 3-shot course of the vaccine. These are striking results, CDC Director Thomas R. Frieden tells the New York Times. They should be a wake-up call that we need to increase vaccination rates. About 79 million, mostly young Americans, are infected with HPV, which is the primary cause of cervical cancer. The CDC says that upping vaccination rates to 80%, a level achieved in many other countries, would prevent almost 17,000 cancer deaths over the lifetimes of girls now 13 or younger. Yet surveys suggest that resistance to the vaccine is growing. Many parents fear that it promotes promiscuity or that it has dangerous side effects, concerns that health officials say have no basis in fact. It is possible to protect the next generation from cancer, says Frieden, and we need to do it. And that takes us to business news. And here we have a couple of articles. The News at a Glance, no more tricky job interviews. And also we have Work, a Bias in Office Flexibility. No more tricky job interviews. Google's done with brain teasers, says Maria Konnikova in NewYorker.com. It turns out that the mind-scrambling job interview questions once used by the search engine giant to vet candidates were totally useless. We found that brain teasers are a complete waste of time, Google executive Laszlo Bock told the New York Times. They don't predict anything. They serve primarily to make the interviewer feel smart. Recent research has found that interviews are generally poor predictors of job performance. Google has replaced its brain teasers, which once included questions such as, how many times a day do a clock's hands overlap, with behavioral assessments, which ask candidates to describe their handling of specific situations and are said to be better predictors of what employees will actually do on the job. The bottom line? More than three-quarters of Americans say they are living paycheck to paycheck with barely enough to scrape by in an emergency. In a survey of 1,000 adults, fewer than one in four said they had enough money to cover expenses for 6 months. Half said they had less than a 3-month cushion, while about a quarter said they had no savings at all. That's from CNN.com. And from the Wall Street Journal, the U.S. economy is expected to generate 55 million jobs by 2020, and 65% of them will require more than a high school diploma. If current graduation rates hold steady, the U.S. will wind up 5 million college-educated workers short. And this from theatlantic.com. A musician whose song gets played 1 million times on Pandora earns just $16.89, according to rates set by the Library of Congress's Copyright Royalty Board. Pandora pays artists as little as a thousandth of a cent each time it plays their songs. And then this from the Wall Street Journal. Office layouts have a large impact on how well workers focus. Researchers say the most effective workplaces include both quiet spaces and collaborative areas. Yet even among workers with private offices, only 54% said their space was ideal for focusing, while 38% said coworkers often disrupted their concentration. Then we have this from retail. Starbucks raises drink prices. Prepare to pay even more for coffee, said Julia Jargon in the Wall Street Journal. Starbucks raised prices by an average of 1% in the U.S. stores last week, marking the first price change in 18 to 24 months for some markets. The coffee giant blamed the hike on higher rent, labor, and non-coffee commodity cost. Starbucks said less than a third of beverages would be affected by the price increase, and that the biggest rise would come to 10 cents, but for more competitive reasons, the company did not give out the new prices for specific drinks. And finally, crime. Enron chief's sentence is reduced. Jeffrey Skilling, Enron's former CEO, will be let out of prison sooner than expected, said Peter Lottman in NewYorkTimes.com. A federal judge in Houston reduced Skilling's sentence for fraud last week from 24 years to 14. The decision came after an appeals court found that the judge had misinterpreted federal sentencing guidelines in Skilling's 2006 trial. Skilling now could leave prison as early as 2017. In exchange for the early release agreement, he agreed not to pursue further appeals and to give up $42 million, which will go to the victims of Enron's fraud. And then there's this work. A bias in office flexibility. Is being single a curse at work? Asked Anya Bird in MarieClaire.com. More and more single women say they carry an undue burden at the office, batting cleanup for their married-with-kids co-workers. That's a reflection, according to social scientist Bella DiPaolo, of our culture favoring married couples and families over singles on everything from discounts on car insurance to preferential treatment in the housing market. A 2011 survey found that 61% of childless women aged 33 to 47 believe their colleagues with children enjoyed more flexibility from employers. Many companies aim to be sensitive to workers' needs beyond the office, but an ugly double standard arises when managers assume that single people don't have lives. Companies are supposed to offer the same flexibility to all of their workers, but single employees might need to demand it by talking with their boss or human resource department. Hear, hear, said Kate Stoffel in NewYorkMagazine.com. Too many employers seem to think that children are the only extra professional pursuit moral enough to justify working a flexible 40-hour week. God forbid a working woman wants to leave work on time because she has a really expensive non-refundable spin class to take instead of diapers to change. And it is still totally taboo, it seems, for workers to want to leave the office because they need to know what happens at the end of Gone Girl. Or they'd like to have a drink outside while it's still light out. But what about single men? Do they similarly sacrifice their free time for office moms and dads? They do, said Tara Siegel Bernard in the New York Times. In fact, men who seek flexibility at work might even be penalized more severely than women because they're viewed as more feminine, deviating from their traditional role of fully committed breadwinners. Studies have shown that while more employers are offering flexible work options such as telecommuting and shortened work weeks, many workers fear that taking advantage of these benefits will harm their positions at work in the long term. That fear is not all in their heads either. One recent study found that men who take paternity leave are less likely to get promoted or receive raises, while women often stop working altogether after having children because they end up with reduced hours and less meaningful assignments. Fortunately, some places, Vermont, for example, have taken action to protect workers who want more flexible work arrangements. But inside many companies and at the national level, workers still seek flexibility at their own peril. And finally, in business news, we have these two short articles. What the Experts Say. Saving for College with a 529. If you're going to be sending a kid to college someday, consider a 529 plan, said Jeff Reeves in USA Today. This government-approved, tax-free investment account is one of the best tools out there to help pay for a child's tuition. Anyone can contribute to a 529, so you can nudge your extended family and friends to pitch in to your offspring's collegiate future, too. Accounts are also transferable, so if one child doesn't go to college, the cash can be transferred to another 529 account without any penalties, and there's no time limit on when the funds need to be used. But you should still research your plan. There are dozens to pick from, and some impose fees, have minimum contributions, and cap how much you can save. Depending on your state, they may also offer some income tax initiatives and incentives. Don't flee the market. Worried about last week's market sell-off? Asked Melanie Hicken in CNN.com. Ignore the knee-jerk reaction to panic and sell, even if Wall Street's recent tumult delivered a hit to your retirement savings. Financial planners say the wisest plan of action is to stay the course. As they always remind us in moments like this, investing in the stock market is inherently volatile, but it's also the best way for retirement savers to build up nest eggs large enough to last decades. Over time, daily market fluctuations will eventually be eclipsed by longer-term gains. And since many retirement accounts are composed of different assets based on your age and career stage, the effects on your portfolio may look different from the headlines. And finally, in business news, we have this article written by Nick Hanauer, Bloomberg.com, The Case for a Minimum Wage of $15. This is no time for small measures, says Nick Hanauer. The fundamental law of capitalism is that if workers have no money, businesses have no customers. As low-wage jobs quickly replace better-paying ones, there's one powerful and elegant antidote to this grave problem, and it's right under our noses. Raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. I know, that sounds like a lot. When President Obama suggested raising the minimum wage from $7.25 to $9 earlier this year, he was accused of being a dangerous redistributionist. But I'm not arguing for a higher minimum wage out of some sense of morality or social justice. I make the case as a businessman, an entrepreneur who sees our millions of low-paid workers as customers to be cultivated and not as costs to be cut. Significantly raising the minimum wage would boost our economy by $450 billion each year, giving more purchasing power to millions and with it more profits to businesses. For the small government set of those who view any meddling with wages as needless government interference, consider this additional benefit. Putting more money in workers' pockets would substantially reduce government intervention and dependency on public assistance programs. You've been listening to The Week magazine, and now we'll turn our attention to some additional sections and columns that were not covered in George Douglas's reading last week. Which brings us to a section I'm sure George does not read, and that's obituaries. And this week there are a couple of interesting ones, so I thought I'd share them with you. The first one is the actor who embodied Tony Soprano in Change TV. This is James Gandolfini, 1961 to 2013. James Gandolfini had a method for inhabiting the character of temper-prone Tony Soprano, the mafia boss he became famous for playing on HBO's The Sopranos. The actor would deliberately drive himself into a rage, hitting himself on the head or depriving himself of sleep, drink 6 cups of coffee, he said, describing his technique, or just walk around with a rock in your shoe. It's silly, but it works. Indeed, it did. Gandolfini made Tony Soprano one of the most complex and memorable characters in all of TV history, a mob boss who could kill men with his bare hands, yet express with just a look a complex inner world of self-doubt, sadness, and angst. He was a genius, said the show's creator, David Chase. A great deal of that genius resided in those sad eyes. I remember telling him many times, "You don't get it. You're like Mozart." Gandolfini was a New Jersey native, said the New York Times, brought up in a family where Italian was the first language. He attended Rutgers University, then worked in Manhattan bars and nightclubs until his acting career took off. In the 1990s, he made gangster roles a specialty, playing a mob hitman twice, opposite Brad Pitt in True Romance, 1993, and then opposite Demi Moore in The Juror, 1996. But he's still largely unknown when TV producer Chase tapped him in 1999 to play Tony Soprano, the conflicted paterfamilias of a New Jersey crime syndicate. The structural and emotional complexity of The Sopranos made it the instrument of a new age of television, said the Los Angeles Times, and Gandolfini's portrayal of the main character was central to its success. Tony Soprano was, as the situation demanded, a villain, a hero, a sex symbol, and a slob. The blunt-speaking mob kingpin struggled to deal with his family at least as much as with his rival gangsters. Over six seasons, Gandolfini turned Tony into the first of a new breed of complex TV anti-heroes. Mad Men's Don Draper and Breaking Bad's Walter White owe him everything. But the daily descent into Tony's psyche took an emotional toll on Gandolfini, said GQ.com. When he divorced his first wife in 2002, court papers revealed issues with cocaine and alcohol, as well as arguments during which he would repeatedly punch himself in the face out of frustration. Friends say he was afflicted with enormous self-doubt, believing himself to be a fat guy from New Jersey who had trouble memorizing lines, not a real actor. He behaved erratically during filming, sometimes failing to show up on set for hours or days. Then out of guilt, he would shower his cast and crew with extravagant gifts like massages or expensive sushi. Gandolfini talked openly of struggling to adjust to life after Tony Soprano, said Bloomberg.com. Although he took small parts in movies such as In the Loop and The Taking of Pelham 123, it was not until he starred in the Broadway show God of Carnage in 2009 that he regained himself as an actor. He recently produced two documentaries about post-traumatic stress in the military. He died of a heart attack while on a trip to a film festival in Italy. Gandolfini once said he identified with Tony Soprano's psychologically distressed more than his murderous rage. "I'm a neurotic mess," he said in 2001. "I'm really basically a 260-pound Woody Allen." And then we have this, the blues singer who was as smooth as Sinatra. This is Bobby Blue Bland, 1930 to 2013. Bobby Bland didn't make it as a blues singer right off the bat, but he was steeped in all the right influences from the very beginning. Soon after he moved to Memphis as a teenager, he joined a group called the Beale Streeters, named after the city's legendary entertainment strip. There he sang alongside guitar legend B.B. King, even becoming his valet and chauffeur for a time, before launching a long hit-making career that established his reputation as the Sinatra of the Blues. Bland was born in the small town of Millington, Tennessee, and abandoned by his father while still very young, said the New York Times. He quit school in the third grade to work in the cotton fields, but soon heard a higher calling in the records of blues guitarist T-Bone Walker. In the early 1950s, Bland recorded a series of songs with Memphis producer Sam Phillips, who later made a star of Elvis Presley, but they went nowhere. After a return from the service in the Army, however, he released a number of hard blues classics like Farther On Up the Road. That became hits. Bland really came into his own in 1958 with Little Boy Blue, where he unveiled his trademark squalling shout and earned his alternative sobriquet, Blue. It was an apt nickname for the satin voice singer, said the Associated Press, because his repertoire focused so closely on lovelorn subject matter. Beginning in 1960, Bland released a dozen R&B hits in a row, including I'll Take Care of You and Turn on Your Love Light. His success continued well into the 70s and 80s, particularly with black audiences. In 1992, Bland was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which cited his amazing 51 singles in the R&B Top 40. Bland was equally comfortable as a smooth balladeer and a propulsive house rocker, and often decorated his crushed velvet performances with a distinctive snort, said Variety. He never achieved the crossover success that his early bandmate B.B. King enjoyed, landing only 4 times in the top 40 pop charts, most prominently with Ain't Nothing You Can Do in 1964. But many of Bland's songs were beloved by rock musicians and recorded by the likes of Eric Clapton, The Grateful Dead, David Bowie, The Band, and Van Morrison. They saw Bland as one of the last survivors of the great Southern blues generation that spawned rock and roll. And that takes us to the section entitled, It Must Be True, I Read It in the Tabloids. A party-loving Australian has pleaded with a judge to be sent to jail, rather than continue to be banned from drinking alcohol. Milo Wilde, 22, was originally sentenced to 3 months in jail following a drunken rampage, but a judge suspended the jail terms on the condition that Wilde refrain from all drinking for 2 years. 7 months into the alcohol ban, Wilde asked Magistrate John O'Neill to let him serve the prison term, saying that he found it unbearable to stay at home while his friends caroused at bars. O'Neill called Wilde's request extraordinary, adding, "There is nothing to do in Darwin for a strong, healthy young man except to drink." And a 52-year-old French mother has been charged with dressing up as her 19-year-old daughter and taking a high school exam in her place. The woman, known only as Caroline D., allegedly wore Converse sneakers, low-rise jeans, and lots of makeups to pose as a teenager while taking the test. But a supervisor spotted the disguise and called police. The mom explained that she knew the subject better than her daughter did. And under Wit and Wisdom, we have this entry from Winston Churchill, quoted in inc.com. Courage is what it takes to stand up and speak. Courage is also what it takes to sit down and listen. And under Poll Watch, we have these two entries. The U.S. is less concerned about climate change than any other part of the world, with only 40% of Americans viewing it as a major threat, compared with 54% of people around the world. This is from the Pew Research Center. And from Gallup, we see the following. Only 30% of Americans say they feel engaged or inspired at work. 50% say they have checked out at work, and 18% say they are actively disengaged, acting out their unhappiness and undermining their coworkers. And under the topic briefing, we have this little insert called The Influence of Women. Have female hawks taken over foreign policy? One of the arguments for having more women in positions of power is that they'd be less susceptible to military confrontations fueled by testosterone. In practice, female office holders have been anything but pacifists. UN Ambassador and future Secretary of State Madeleine Albright pushed then-chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Colin Powell to intervene in the Balkans. What's the point of having this superb military that you're always talking about if we can't use it? she asked. Likewise, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice joined the neocons in advocating the Iraq war. Under Obama, Hillary Clinton, Susan Rice, and Samantha Power have been strong advocates of intervention in Libya and Syria. In the Balkans, it took 3 years for the international community to use air power, said Power. In noting that trio's influence in Libya, it took a little more than a month. And that takes us to the section entitled Review of Reviews. And this is for music. And we start out with an entry that has 4 out of a possible 4 stars. And it's a review of the reviews of Kanye West's new album, which is Yeezus, spelled Y-E-E-Z-U-S. Kanye West's latest opus challenges listeners to erase all previous notions of what hip-hop should be, said Keith Murphy in Vibe. An electro-progressive punk album masquerading as a rap album? It's surely West's most divisive work yet. But in its mix of profane, stream of consciousness rapping with an assaultive landscape of samples and synths, it also bolsters the case that the 36-year-old star is the most important artist of his generation. Each track on Yeezus charges out of the gate, sometimes switching sounds and textures without bothering to maintain tempo, said Sasha Frere Jones in The New Yorker. It's all technically breathtaking, and West regularly stops the sound mid-track as if he never wants you to forget that he is standing over the boards. For lyrics, West lets his ID rule, his id rule, delivering some of the most narcissistic, sex-obsessed lines of his career. 20 years from now, West's previous albums will remain important, but a new generation may first gravitate to the lean vibrancy of this one. And then we have this review of reviews for Sigur Rós. For their latest album, it's given 3 out of 4 stars, and the name of the album is Kvikur. That's spelled K-V-E-I-K-U-R. This is by far the most propulsive primal outing Sigur Rós has made, said Barry Walters in Spin. Known for ambient, almost New Age music, the Icelandic rock group was recently forced to alter its sound after the departure of Kjartan Sveinsson, whose keyboard playing and string arrangements made all the orchestral splendor possible. At first, it's unnerving to witness indie's most celebrated airy fairies butch it up, but the result ultimately satisfies, especially because the former quartet had already pushed their old sound as far as it could go. Who would have thought that circa 2013, the group most eerily capturing the world's collective neuroses would be Sigur Rós, said Jason Heller in AV Club. While this album opens with 8 minutes of industrial abrasion and eventually arrives at some transcendent moments that recall past records, Kvikur mostly traffics in leaner, starker music that feels withdrawn, even agoraphobic. Joni Birgerson's familiar falsetto is still there, but now it evokes apocalyptic resignation. That takes us to the section of the magazine that George probably did cover, but not all of these articles, called Talking Points. And we have here at least one article that he may not have covered, Exodus, Praying Away the Gay Doesn't Work. And this was sort of hidden away in the bottom of one of the pages. It takes a lot of courage and honesty to admit you were wrong, said Exodus International has done just that, said Marlo Thomas in HuffingtonPost.com. For 37 years, the controversial Christian ministry was the driving force of the ex-gay movement, which maintains that gay men and lesbians can change their sexual orientation through prayer and psychotherapy. But last week, Exodus's president, Alan Chambers, joined the ever-increasing chorus of voices in our nation calling for kindness, tolerance, and decency, and announced his organization's closure. Apologizing for the pain and hurt Exodus has caused, Chambers said he no longer believed that reparative therapy changes sexual orientation, and in fact does great harm to many people. The idea of conversion therapy was always absurd, said Susan Milligan in USNews.com. If one could choose one's sexual orientation, why make a choice that will make you the target of discrimination, violence, hatred, and even murder? And then we have this. The IRS, end of a scandal? Remember the IRS scandal, said Alex Seitzwald in Salon.com. For more than a month, Republicans have been insisting that the agency deliberately targeted Tea Party groups, seeking tax-exempt status for special harassment, openly suggesting it was acting on White House orders. Turns out, that whole scandal is entirely bogus, false, a fiction. Newly released transcripts of testimony from an IRS official in Cincinnati show that the decision to target groups was made locally, not by IRS officials in Washington. But the final nail in the coffin was this week's news that liberal groups with keywords like progressive and Occupy in their names were also targeted for special review. So, no Nixonian political vendetta, just the IRS trying to cope with an avalanche of 40,000 applications by partisan organizations seeking tax-exempt status. This should put the matter to bed forever. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, filling in for George Douglas. Triangle Radio Reading Services wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast, at our website, Triangle Reading Service, that's one word, .org. If you have questions or comments, please don't hesitate to contact us at 919-832-5138. So long. Until next time.